Hello, everyone. This is the podcast for our class today, August 25th. It's officially class number 2. And in this class, we finished up talking about vicarious liability, and that is continuation from last class when we were talking about respondeat superior. Here in the Rossler case, it was a case where the hospital here tried to evade the strict liability aspects of respondeat superior by saying, oh, the tortfeasor here, our radiologist, was not an employee of the hospital, was just an independent contractor, so the hospital shouldn't be responsible for any of their actions. And the court talked a lot about different standards for agency. The thing to remember here for you, I mean, we spent a certain amount of time, and I think it was a good use of our time, but I don't want you to get too bogged down in the laws of agency. The thing to recall here is that the court was willing to say that it's the appearance, how somebody appears, that determines whether whether the tortfeasor will be considered, whether the employer will be considered to be vicariously liable, even though they may not be an official employee. If they appear to be an employee, and that's a matter of fact, if a reasonable person coming in to use the services could consider them to be employees, then for purposes of liability, vicarious liability will apply. Using some mechanical, formalistic, contract-based notions such as agency, it does not fit in with our flexible standards aspects of torts. So, again, don't get all caught up with the rules of agency. All we're really concerned with here is remembering that vicarious liability is really strict liability, and employers will do anything to avoid those strict liability aspects. Then we moved into our discussion, really, that the meat of it, which is Chapter 2, Establishment of the Fault Principle. And we quickly went through the little case of Brown v. Kendall. I did that case myself because it's not all that. The important thing is to here is to take away from this that up until the mid-1800s, the concept of fault was not part of our tort system. Strict liability, such as trespass, liability for trespass, which would have been the cause of action, the valid cause of action for the Brown v. Kendall case, was a strict liability concept. If you hit somebody directly, if you injure them directly, it was trespass and you're strictly liable. The modern concept of fault developed because they wanted to get away from that strict liability. It's important to keep in mind that the concept of fault as a basis for liability is much less harsh on defendants than liability under strict liability. Under negligence, there's always going to be less liability than under a system of strict liability. And so because of this, strict liability is seen by all of these thinkers, such as Posner and Holmes, strict liability is seen as something that inhibits activity and freedom of choice. So Brown v. Kendall, even though it was just a dogfight, hitting the head with a stick, it had a huge impact. The reason for the case made risk-creating enterprise less hazardous to investors and entrepreneurs, such as Gregory said that on page 39. Mid-19th century was a time of reform in the law. We moved away from strict pleading rules, moved away from rigid rules, less structure, more generalization. Until this case, the only real inquiry was whether there was something about the circumstances of the injury that should compel the defendant to pay damages. until this case, burden of proof was on the defendant to show that they it was a necessary action and that they behaved with extraordinary care. After this case, negligence now is the system, and it provides the first real theoretical framework for torts. Up until this time, it was just an odd assortment of legal actions kind of thrown together. Then we talked about the structure of negligence. Remember, always keep in mind, duty, breach, causation, cause in fact, damages. In that order, they must be shown in order to have a valid cause of action for negligence, for a case of valid liability under negligence. Duty and breach in and of itself are negligent. You can have a negligent behavior, but unless it causes some injury, you're not going to be liable. I'm driving down Church Street at 90 miles an hour. I'm negligent. I have a duty to behave reasonably, and 90 miles an hour isn't reasonable care under anybody's standard. But I don't cause any injuries. I'm not liable for a cause of action for negligence, even though I'm negligent. You're standing there, you see me speeding, there's no liability because I cause no injuries. So all five of those elements, and those are what we call the elements for a cause of action for negligence, all five of them have to be shown. But we first start talking about breach. Our standard of care. How are you supposed to behave? That's what our standard of care means. Just a standard of behavior. If you have a duty to behave reasonably, how do you breach that standard? Under who determines what's reasonable care? Breach is a matter of fact. And we saw that in the Adams v. Bullock case. Adams v. Bullock, Cardozo says, even though the two lower courts had said liability, jury in a jury decision, Cardozo comes along and says, no, although our defendant had a duty of care because they were doing an activity, there are no facts, insufficient facts to show that they breached that duty, that they behaved unreasonably, that they took unreasonable risks, they created unreasonable risks. And how did he decide that? He went through the facts. They didn't breach any custom. Nothing like this had happened before. There had been no further injury. There wasn't any more that they could do reasonably to make anything any safer. That was his conclusion. You see, I mean, I said Cardozo, he kind of hijacked that case. The plaintiff has the burden of proof, and the plaintiff could have shown other examples. This case is a real good example of untaken precautions. Remember, could have, should have. There are always more things you could do, but should you have done them? When the untaken precautions, the number of them get to be so large, or the precautions themselves get to be so easy, could haves then go into should haves, and that makes breach of your reasonable care. But here, it's just important for you to remember that breach is fact-based. It's not something that, oh, I think they behaved unreasonably. We have to have the facts to back it up, because the jury decides whether something was a breach of the duty of reasonable care, and juries decide the facts. So next class, we're going to go into what standards have been raised to determine breach. What are standards that have been used to determine what is or what is not reasonable care? So next class, we'll start with a very, very famous case of U.S. v. Carroll Towing.